Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, Matt Grimm with the Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network will talk about the work that organization is doing to improve the lives of young people. Today, we'll take you on another road trip, this time down Ohio's Route 33, and we'll continue our readings from the Antioch Writers' Workshop. Today, poet Jeff Gundy. Up first, most of us find it difficult to grieve the passing of a loved one. When our parents die, it can be especially difficult, leaving us with regrets, guilt, and other unresolved feelings. We expect it, but what about their stuff? The tangible objects our parents have accumulated over a lifetime, what happens to all of that? Community Voices producer Mark Babb visited with Everything But the House, an online estate auction company in Cincinnati, as they sorted through the possessions of a recently deceased couple to try and find out about what we leave behind and what it says about us.
There's pictures everywhere. My dad couldn't take a very good picture, I don't think. You know, a lot of out-of-focus stuff. But there are little gems everywhere.
That's Bob Fries. His parents recently died 10 days apart from each other. I spoke with Bob at his parents' home in an affluent neighborhood in Cincinnati. The house had just been sold, and its new owners want to take possession in a few weeks. The house is an impressive, if a bit weathered, colonial from the early 1900s. The bushes are overgrown, and the pool in the backyard is covered by a plastic tarp held down with bags of sand. In the driveway, I meet Brian Graves, co-owner of the company that's going to inventory, photograph, and auction off the contents of the house. We come into the house through a garage into a lower-level family room. In it, we find a cluttered mess of furniture and boxes. A large banker's box lid full of prescription bottles sits on a TV tray next to a bookcase. I ask Brian to show me around. As he does, he sizes up potential for the auction.
You can see that this is a family that was here for a long period of time. Mm-hmm. I have period and antiques from New England, so 18th century Chippendale six-drawer chests. At the same time, you know, I'm looking at Bowback Windsors. One room adjacent, we have a circa 1860 Empire crotch mahogany bookcase.
Brian and his co-owner Jackie Denny started Everything But the House in 2007, and their business has grown steadily in the last 5 years. He tells me that most people are completely overwhelmed by the prospect of sorting through their relatives' stuff. They have to get rid of things, but they still have attachments that make it hard to let go. When the auction is ready, there's often a day when potential bidders can walk through the house and inspect the items. Sometimes it's best if the family's not there.
The family member sitting at the front door in a chair, sizing up everybody that walks in, is a difficult scenario for them and the people that are interested in buying. It can become very personal and very emotional.
Brian believes in the auction process because he says you never know what significance people will place on a particular item. He tells me the story of a prior auction.
It was a Ladybug refrigerator magnet, plastic, faded, nothing, you know, that interesting. I even questioned why one of my crew leaders actually cataloged it on its own. And at the end of the day, that Ladybug magnet sold for $65.
Why?
The person that bought it had a similar one when they were a kid. They hung up their homework with it. They wanted to be able to show their kids.
From the kitchen, we climb up a set of stairs into the attic. On the wall, in a steep staircase, was a large painted portrait of what was probably one of the couple's grandchildren. A boy, maybe about 10, was pictured sitting casually on a front porch swing. The portrait wasn't tagged to be kept by the heirs, which seemed sort of sad. I wondered what would become of it.
What do you do, Brian, what do you do with something like this?
This is, you know, a painting. You know, typically something like this, it's a portrait, it's a family member, you know, it's obviously dated 1982. Well accomplished, you know, the person that did it did a great job, but of course it's a very personal item.
Is this going to hit the website?
I'd say it will, yeah. It's an original painting. Somebody put a heck of a lot of work into it. Let's let the public decide.
Let's let the public decide, he says. At the top of the stairs, Brian turns on a light to reveal an enormous expanse of clutter. Stacks of old National Geographic magazines, old electronics, old pennants, and dozens of open boxes of what looks to be junk.
So, of course, this is the last thing you see when you're on the appointment with the client.
The appointment is when Brian first tours the house with the family.
This is an accumulation of decades of we didn't have anywhere else to put it. We didn't want to throw it away, so let's put it up in the attic.
I ask him why he thinks we buy and hang on to so much stuff.
I think it's redirection of you know, an interest and a passion. It's something to keep, you know, keep ourselves busy, and it's not knowing when to stop. The hardest thing for us to do is walk into some of those situations where someone has spent their life's fortune buying things that they don't really need. People are attached to objects. America is the accumulation nation, and people have a hard time giving things up. You know, it's definitely an exception when you have that person that has no attachment to anything.
Bob Fries seems like the exception. He's downstairs thumbing through his father's old blurry photographs. He's not interested in keeping much of his parents' stuff, except a couple of small items like this one that belonged to his father.
Yeah, like a little newspaper stand, you know, a silver newspaper stand where when you're eating breakfast, you put the newspaper in it, and it kind of stands up in front of you. Yeah. Downstairs, you know, that was part of his, you know, memory of his life, his childhood even, because his father read off of that thing. It's got a little bent up now and stuff like that, a little older than it used to be, but it's just part of something I remember, and I'm fond of it.
Bob has a sense of ease about this transition in his life. As we talk, he becomes more and more interesting. He starts asking me about my recording equipment, and I learn that Bob has spent the last 40 years working on TV, music, and film productions. He even made a famous film called Ladies and Gentlemen, the Rolling Stones, in collaboration with the band. Before that, he spent 5 years in New York making avant-garde films for John Lennon and Yoko Ono.
At that point, I was editing this huge amount of film, you know, which was a bunch of, you know, frame by frame by frame by frame, you know, and Yoko would say, do this, and then she'd go away and tear your eye. Anyway, it was great. And I lived at the hotel. We lived there for 6 months doing this stuff. And the film was Imagine.
As Bob told me the stories of his work and the people he'd gotten to know, the weight of the situation seemed to lift. It at least became clear that his parents had left behind more than old furniture and magazines.
Imagine no possessions.
For WYSO's Community Voices, I'm Mark Batt.
For more information about the WYSO Community Voices Project, visit WYSO.org and sign up for our mailing list. Join us next Tuesday and Sunday for more new work from WYSO's latest Community Voices producers. This is WYSO Weekend on WYSO. In our weekly series Road Trip, radio producers from around the state take you on audio tours from the new Ohio Guide. This week, we'll explore tour number 9, Ohio's Route 33.
Hi, I'm Sandra Sleiprennen, and for this road trip tour, you'll be traveling with me. Today, we're traveling along Route 33, and our first stop is in the town of Logan. Logan has long produced clay products. There were once a number of clay companies here, and those clay products and others that were locally produced all left town one way, by the Hocking Canal. Built in the 1830s, the canal ran from Athens to Carroll. Dr. David Mould of Ohio University has studied transportation routes in the Hocking River Valley.
The canals had been the first major public works project for the state of Ohio, a massive investment to open up the state to commerce.
The 56-mile canal cost about $1 million to build. It had 26 locks, 7 culverts, and 1 aqueduct. A few of these canal remnants still exist along Route 33. Geographer Tom O'Grady has visited most of them. He took me to a piece of the canal that was right on Old Route 33 in Logan at Old Town Creek.
Old Town Creek coming through here, and the canal came across Old Town Creek.
So the canal went this way?
There's a parking lot and a walking trail there now, but the aqueduct is unmarked. The cut stones arch up and over the creek. The canal once did that too. It went over the creek. And when you walk to the back side of the structure, what you see is amazing.
See the old trees?
The logs.
The logs. Those are trees. They were laid across the creek, and then the superstructure of that culvert was built on top of them.
What you'll see is a cut stone keystone arch that crosses the creek. But from this side, you also see that it's been built on logs that span the creek.
logs that have been there for over 170 years.
So since they've been underwater the whole time, they've been pretty well preserved. Those are trees that were cut down in Haakon County, probably in the 1820s, 1830s. Those are some remnants of the primeval forest of southeast Ohio.
Wow. It's amazing. It's hard to believe it's that old.
I'd always wondered how they cut those massive stones. I found my answer in Logan. Logan native Sam Stone had heard the story.
And they would drill a hole in the rock, then they would take oak pegs and drive down in, then they'd pour water on top of them. Then the water would go into the pegs and expand, and that would break that off. Then they'd come back the next day and they'd all be broke loose. And that's how they got that stuff loose to wring it out.
Simple tools, wood and water, to get such dramatic results. Although most of the canal is gone, its presence is still felt along Route 33. There are canal locks preserved near Haydenville and Nelsonville, and another stone culvert exists near Haydenville. The ballpark at Nelsonville boasts bleachers made by WPA workers out of the canal block, and Route 33 in Nelsonville used to be the canal. That's why so many houses have backyards that back onto Route 33 or Canal Street. Reporting from Logan, Ohio, I'm Sandra Sleikbrennan.
You can download the new Ohio Guide tours at coohiofirst.org. The new Ohio Guide is produced by the Ohio Humanities Council, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us. And joining me in studio, Matt Grimm, co-chair of the Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network, also known as GLSEN. Matt, welcome to the studios.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Tell me a little bit about your job as co-chair with this organization.
My job as co-chair, actually, I oversee the entire chapter. The board is broken into two different parts. We have the management team, which consists of the co-chairs. There are two of us. And then we have the secretary, treasurer. And then we have the board members who oversee, you know, different functions, fundraising and things like that. My job as co-chair is just to kind of oversee the entire operation, make sure we're following in line with GLSEN's mission, make sure that our events and activities and press releases and things like that are in line with what GLSEN is and what GLSEN stands for.
And as far as your work, you're actually working to make schools safer for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender youth.
Correct. Not just the LGBT youth, the allies as well. Our allies are a big part of what we do. So we are working to make sure that every school is a safe and inclusive space for our students. So.
Let's go into a little bit of history.
Well, GLSEN actually started in 1990. It was the Gay, Lesbian, Straight Teachers Network. And then in 1995, GLSEN actually, we went national. It was actually started by two teachers in 1990. In 97, GLSEN actually became to what it is now, GLSEN, the Gay, Lesbian, Straight Education Network. In 1999, we did our first national climate school survey. And basically, we just every 2 years, we survey the students in the schools and get the feedback from the students just to kind of see where we are. In 2001, we actually partnered with MTV for the first time, and we became the national sponsor for the Day of Silence. In 2003, we developed the first student leadership program, and in 2004, we created the National No Name Calling Week. In 2008, we partnered with the Ad Campaign to create the Think Before You Speak campaign. The commercials you've probably seen on TV with Wanda Sykes and I think Hillary Duff. In 2012, we did our second research briefs were released for elementary schools. It's the first one of its kind, Playgrounds and Prejudice, and it just kind of gives us the atmosphere of the elementary schools from the students' perspective.
So since the beginning of your organization, it sounds like you've made a lot of progress. And mm-hmm. with this two-year survey that's done, I'm wondering how things have progressed overall in schools.
Well, I'm anxious to see myself. We just wrapped up the 2011 survey. In 2009, each survey that we do is broken into states that we get the results from. Obviously, not every state. We don't get a lot of responses from every state. We don't get a lot of responses from the students, you know. But from what we do get, you know, in 2009, that was our last one. We just wrapped up the 2011 survey. So we expect those results coming out sometime soon. But, you know, just in 2009, 23% of the students here in Ohio were, you know, physically assaulted because of their sexual identity or gender expression or sexual orientation. 45% were physically harassed and 91% were verbally harassed. So I'm kind of anxious to see how that stands up when the 2011 results come out. In 2007, these numbers were a little bit higher. So we are seeing, you know, a small deduction in the percents of students that report harassment and abuse. So
what kind of dynamics are you seeing as far as the attitudes of allies?
Nowadays, I think that the allies, they're becoming greater in number. You know, this is a subject that if a student goes to a teacher or something and says they're being bullied, the schools kind of send up red flags because no school wants to be identified as the school that's being bullied. No school wants to be in the news for that. And so I think that this issue, you know, it's becoming bigger. You know, we're starting to see a lot more allies, which is great. I also kind of think, though, it's a generational thing. You know, the younger the students are, you know, the more common this is. You know, for the older generation, it wasn't so common to find, you know, a gay student in a classroom or a gay student out and about. It is now. It's a lot more – it's becoming more mainstream, I'd say. So, you know, it's great that we're getting as many allies that we are.
Let's talk about some of the consequences of not improving the situation. Certainly higher rates of truancy and youth suicide.
A lot of the students we're finding are missing school more and more. I read a number recently where I think it was about 600,000 in the entire nation in 2010 missed at least a day of school. That's 600,000 students because they felt unsafe in the school. You know, there was an incident in Chillicothe. I just recently attended an ACLU conference in Columbus, and I got the pleasure of sitting next to Zach, who was a student in Chillicothe, that, you know, he was just going into his homeroom, just, you know, going to school, normal day, and four kids, you know, laid him on the ground and just started beating him up. You know, no student expects that. No student should deserve that. Every student deserves the right to learn. And one of the things that we do is try to get the teachers to step in. And if the teachers are afraid to do that, this is what happens. You know, students get depressed or students start skipping school. They don't feel like they can go outside. You know, I had an incident in high school where I was bullied. And, you know, for the longest time afterwards, I was depressed. I didn't want to go to school. I even begged my mom to let me go live with my aunt in another state. You know, it gives students negative side effects.
Let's talk about some of the activities and programs that GLSEN offers. You've got Think Before You Speak.
Mm-hmm.
And let's talk about that.
The Think Before You Speak campaign, and actually I'm going to reference their website real quick. Think Before You Speak is a wonderful, wonderful campaign. We ran commercials and, you know, Wanda Sykes did a few. And basically it's just to get students to stop and think what they're about to say. You know, they reference the "that's so gay" phrase, you know. A lot of people don't realize how hurtful that is to some people. You know, we're wanting students to stop, and not just students though, a lot of the teachers and parents and adults, to stop, think what you're about to say before you say it. And on the website, there's a little feed on the left-hand side, and it monitors Twitter from the start of each day. And it counts how many times the word "that's so gay" was used, how many times the word "dyke" and "fag" were used. If you check as soon as you wake up, you know, like at 6 a.m. or something, the number's pretty low. But you check at noon, and it tops out at 1,500. And then for the rest of the day, I mean, you know, that's as high as the count goes. But it's a campaign to try to end that verbal abuse.
So that is essentially an organization that you're working with. On
the Ad
campaign.
Council, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's talk about Days of Action.
Days of Action, we actually do a few. Ally Week, which is coming up in October, it's October 15th. And basically, Ally Week is a week for students to organize events that serve to identify, support, and celebrate allies against anti-LGBT language, bullying, and harassment in the schools. You know, students plan appropriate events in their school communities, and we're here to help. We're here to give resources and assist them with planning those events. Basically, that's a week just to recognize our allies and tell them, hey, we appreciate everything that you do. Our allies are our strongest partners. We also do the Day of Silence. That's a national day of silence. It's basically an action day which students across the country, they take a form of silence. They don't talk for the entire day. Now, one thing that I do have to say, though, is if students participate, we encourage them a day or a few days before to let the administration know. You know, 16, 17 students show up to school and none of them are talking or they wear duct tape. We found the educators don't like surprises. So that being said, the day of silence is basically a day where students can go in and remain silent for the day. And we have these little cards that they can hand out saying, my name is so-and-so, I'm remaining silent to honor the LGBT, my LGBT friends and family that have been silenced by bullying. We also do No Name Calling Week. It's an annual week of educational activities that are aimed at ending name calling of all kinds. We just started the Changing the Game. It's basically the GLSEN Sports Project. And basically its mission is to just bring what we do in the classrooms out onto the field and out onto the track, out onto the basketball court. You know, we're wanting to create and maintain an athletic and physical education climate that's based on the core principles of respect and safety.
Have there been any pushback against any of these initiatives?
Here in the greater Dayton area, the Miami Valley, and you know, now we're expanding into the Columbus, there hasn't really been any pushback. The thing that we're seeing is, you know, we're reaching out to the schools and letting them know we're here, who we are, and what we do. A lot of the things that we get back in response is, well, we don't have an issue, or there's no bullying issue at the school, or we have some form of a bullying policy in place. That's not really what we're after. It's great that you may not have a bullying problem. I can almost guarantee you that there is some form of bullying going on in that school. What we're here is to prevent an issue. So when things like what happened in Chillicothe, that's when the schools say, we don't want this to happen to us, so come talk to us, come do what you need to do. That's great, but we want to prevent that. We want to get in there ahead of time and talk to the students and talk to the educators and let them know, you know, a student being beaten up should not have to happen for you to open your eyes.
Matt Grimm, co-chair of the Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network, or GLSEN. Thanks for speaking with us. And any final comments?
Just check out the GLSEN webpage. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. We're constantly tweeting or you know, I've just gotten into the whole Twitter thing, so I'm eating that up. Other than that, just check out the Facebook. We're always looking for volunteers.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Find out more about GLSEN on Facebook at GLSEN Greater Dayton. This is Why So Weekend. Today we continue our series of faculty readings from the Antioch Writers' Workshop. Jeff Gundy is a Mennonite poet from Ohio whose work deals with a variety of subjects from historical to autobiographical. It begins with a poem written after a walk in Glen Helen.
I could walk up or down the creek, but I stop. So little time. Here's the strainer someone left on the rocks. The air so damp, it's 1 degree from fog. Here's the weed rooted somehow in the mossy boulder, almost ready to seed. Despite much instruction, I've never mastered the simple, clear explanation. I've never figured out how to put ideas into things. In this simple, indescribably deep forest, I remember last night when we were suddenly talking about what might survive our bodies, and my new friend said, I could go to church if I didn't have to believe all that stuff. And I said I knew what she meant. But the beer was gone, and we were tired. I got in the car, and the singer sang Three Crosses in a Copse of Trees, a long way from Calvary. And I found my room, slept, woke into another irrevocable and precious day, and put not one idea into a thing. I spoke mostly to the one inside who listens darkly to my obnoxious supplementary monologues, the one who says very little beyond walk then, and sit here, and listen, and wait. There are many things. The mossy boulder, a dead leaf sprawled on it, some wispy grass, lichens, a foot tall weed almost ready to seed, and not an idea in the whole passel. Where the creek turns, a mist rose or lowered or gathered. The whole forest spun without moving and hummed without noise, simple and clear and enormous. All these adjectives must die, I know, and be flung on a heap like the honeysuckle that the weed witch is clearing to let the natives flourish. Skunk cabbage, spice bush, jack in the pulpit. I am a native, but not exactly at home. So I listened to the nearby water and the distant water, and a drop fell on my shoulder like a reason to turn. I live up in northwest Ohio near a little town called Defiance, and it's a historic sort of place, and there's some history in the poem. I'm not going to go over a lot of that, but there's also some history of Washington, D.C., the Civil War, Walt Whitman that comes into the poem. I've been kind of working on this for a long time, and I hope it comes together. Somewhere near Defiance, and the epigraph is from Naomi Shihab Nye. It's late, but everything comes next. I live near Defiance, a white name pressed on an old place. Mad Anthony Wayne's soldiers broke down the orchards when the battle was theirs and built a fort where the Auglaize and Maumee rivers meet. Water will answer anything, the moon, the wind, the mud. The rivers mingle and move on. Once I drove my little car right into the heart of the empire, huddled with my friends to plot and complain. All over town, the poets and other malcontents were hiding in the open, vowing to split the rocks and terrify the despots. In the coffee house, we tallied our losses and wondered how to subvert the lyric eye until the hot waitress grabbed the mic to say that racism wasn't over yet. We clapped for her, then wandered toward the Capitol, launched some ragged words to each other and the wind. All right, you can have shock, we told the adversary, but awe belongs to us. Walt Whitman thought his poems might stop the war. When they did not, he moved to Washington, took a day job so he could go to the field hospitals, read to the wounded, write letters for men with no arms or eyes. I have been hurt, but am mending well. Do not weep, I will find you one day. I walked around for days, found no field hospitals, lots of monuments. I passed the suited and booted, shaggy and lame, proud and weary, and it seemed that each of us carried a wound we were trying to hide. Meanwhile, the drone pilots turned their hellfires loose from dark rooms in the suburbs by a six-pack on the way home. 1,200 veterans of the good war die each day, and the stools at the VFW stand like puzzled mushrooms. These days, I wake up grateful that my heavy dreams are gone. I snag the zipper of my coat, pull it free, and walk off, puzzling over slides and words and stratagems. Then I step into a room and see a row of faces, hopeful and new, as yellow apples hanging in the orchards of Defiance. The morning came brilliant to my quiet town, sun in the junipers, a robin on the wire. Nothing that I do matters to the earth or the sky. But I've stalled around too long. It's time for declarations, time for floods, time to put down the Toledo blade and take a very long walk, time to say peace on terror, peace on drugs, peace on Defiance. Peace on Mad Anthony and his soldiers, gone so quiet now, and the warriors they fought, and the fruit trees they tore. The Auglaize and the Maumee join and drift on, exchanging sticks and soil and bits of news. We are in the earth already, and the earth in us. Even from Defiance, nothing's more than half a world away. And I'll end with this one. This is just kind of a, I don't know, it's sort of a weird, loopy, fragmentary autobiography, I guess you could say. Yeah. It's all true, except for what isn't. Yeah. And it's called Slippers. I used to believe I could be a crow or a pheasant running long-tailed and pretty down the rows of broken stalks, oblivious of shotguns. I used to believe in spontaneous rebirth, in the multiplicity of rewards, in the indefinite renewal of overdue books. I used to dream of the wearying privilege of travel, the miraculous beauty tapping at the motel door at 2 a.m., saying, "It's Angel." I used to believe that each step was easy and that I could recover from any fall. I used to run and never get tired in the humid summer dusk, playing horses with my cousins at somebody's birthday party through the ditch lilies and the high grass. I did not believe then that every step contained a fall. I had never watched a man work his way slowly from wheelchair to car seat, his shirt and pale belly spilling out. I would never have thought the snow would pile this deep, would last this long, that I would walk the icy narrow paths, looking down, leaning forward, careful as any man who's fallen more than once, any man thinking of his Christmas slippers and soft chair just 100 steps away, 12. I used to believe that every step was too slow, that I would run faster next year, that I would rise up stronger each time I fell, spitting out the mouthpiece, my whole body singing from the stranger's helmet, from the stranger's body breaking over mine. Thank you.
That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook. But first, here's Sarah Buckingham with a preview of tonight's Sunday Documentary Hour, tonight at 6 and 11.
A brand new season of State of the Reunion starts tonight at 6 p.m. There's so much talk about community that we lose perspective of what that means and of the stories of real people making homes, lives, and neighborhoods across the country. On State of the Reunion, host Al Lutzen travels to find those stories and tells them with grace, perspective, and deep curiosity. That's State of the Reunion, each Sunday at 6 p.m., starting tonight